Welcome to Alaska's Native Voice. I'm Antonia Gonzalez from the National Congress of American Indians Mid-Year Gathering at the Dena'ina Center in Anchorage. At NCAI, tribal leaders, advocates, young people, and many others are gathered to discuss top issues facing their communities. Among concerns is policy making, not only within the U.S., but to ensure Indigenous people are included in talks all levels of government, from local to international, especially when it comes to climate change and the environment. And joining me now is Jennifer Nelson. Welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Please introduce yourself.
Sure. My name is Jennifer Nelson. I am the current chairman of the board of directors for the Aleut Corporation. Also represent Aleut International Association, which is a permanent participant group of the Arctic Council and on the Arctic Economic Council. And then my day job is director of rural affairs for GCI.
Well, thank you so much for that, and thank you for being here and joining us. And why is it important that tribes not only have a seat at the table, but they're in the whole process of decision-making?
Gosh, that is actually the most important component of all policymaking and decision-making, is really understanding that local knowledge, that Indigenous knowledge, because those policies affect those people living on those lands and those homelands that they have lived on for millennia.
And the National Congress of American Indians Mid-Year Gathering taking place here in Alaska, there's nearly half of all the federally recognized tribes in the United States are located here in Alaska. So a lot of the agenda is focused on Alaska issues, which also mirror a lot of the issues facing lower 48 tribes, including environmental issues. So what are some of the things you're hearing from attendees that they are, you know, looking to address when it comes to climate change and the environment?
Yeah, climate change is really an important issue as we look at continuing living our ways of life or just living where we've lived. You know, there was a heartwarming story talking about erosion and how her village, even just this week, the more has eroded and more has eroded, limiting how they can get in and out of their community, how they can receive goods and services like diesel fuel to create power. So there's true, real impacts that are happening. I mean, the skies today are a little bit clear, but they've been hazy because there's been a tremendous amount of forest fires that are also impacting communities and having them having to evacuate. When it comes to how all that with policy is, the policymakers really need to understand the impacts of that policy and how it will impact those communities and their ways of life, just surviving.
And usually these gatherings, there's local leaders come, state leaders come, and definitely federal leaders and other officials, a lot of the Biden administration, different agencies that tribes work with. And, you know, the federal government has a trust responsibility to that. And so there's also Native people and a need for Indigenous people to be in all levels of government.
Yeah, absolutely. That is extremely important. Like, not only showing up to gatherings like this and listening to concerns and hearing about the good things that are happening, you know, within communities, but being at those top levels and having that voice and having that seat at the table is of the utmost importance.
And I want to also introduce another guest who is joining us today. Yes, please introduce yourself.
Yes, Uvunga Daly Samodoro. I am presently the International Chair of the Inuit Circumpolar Council. I am a tribal member of the Native Village of Unalakleet and happy to be here today.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. And Jennifer and I were just discussing why it's so important to have Indigenous people not only be at the table when there's policy making, but all the way in the process to decision making to when it becomes even law.
No, this is absolutely crucial. And I think that gatherings like the NCAI Mid-Year Conference allows for information to be shared, but even more significantly for our people as leaders, as Indigenous peoples, especially on crucial issues like climate change and a wide array of other issues that we're informed and that our voices are elevated and really the volume turned up on how issues like climate change are impacting our communities. So absolutely no question that the role that we play and the perspectives that we bring to especially policy and decision making is absolutely crucial. Too often we are left out of these important debates and dialogues and decisions. So it's central to be at the forefront of all of these issues on behalf of our communities, our distinct communities.
And even though there are people here from all across the country, a lot of the decision and policy making, you know, it's coming together and working together. Our producer, Emily Schwing, got a chance to visit with Fawn Sharp, who is currently the president of the National Congress of American Indians. And she discussed why it's also so important to be involved in policymaking. Let's hear from her.
Do you have any examples of, like, times where you're like, wow, that policy could be so much richer and so much more meaningful had somebody consulted with the local or regional tribe or, you know, indigenous decision makers?
Yes, absolutely. Back in 2018, there was a movement to run a citizens initiative. It was called I-1631. And initially, the environmental community prepared this initiative and wanted us to simply approve it and support it and endorse it. And we had asked them, have you had a chance to consult with tribes? And they said no. So we asked them to, you know, politely disengage and let us work intertribally on a set of policy points, which included 10% of all carbon revenues on a carbon pricing mechanism to tribal nations since we're disproportionately impacted. It called for $50 million of biennium to assist us in relocating our villages to higher ground. And so the fossil fuel industry spent $33 million to kill that campaign. It was the largest campaign in Washington state history. We ultimately came back and secured the Climate Commitment Act and passed it in the Washington state legislature. But had we not been at the table for that conversation, we wouldn't have been able to realize the opportunity to secure funding for the critical needs facing Indian country directly from those who are responsible industry, because right now the public treasury simply isn't enough to deal with the scale of climate change.
Where do you see gaps needing to be filled?
Where gaps are needing to be filled is in the space where tribal nations should have a decisive say over our land, territories, resources, and people. And you may hear tribal leaders talk about FPIC, free, prior, and informed consent. It's been our experience that when we have a conflict, whether it's clean energy or dirty energy, there seems to be this idea that a country could take unilateral action, permit something, and then ask us or not even consult with us. And so it's very important that tribal nations have a decisive say over our land, territories, and resources. And that's a major gap and a place that we're advocating for a dispute resolution mechanism short of litigation, because right now our only option is to file a lawsuit.
And that was Fawn Sharp, who is president of the National Congress of American Indians, talking about a lot of stuff. Jennifer, go ahead and just some of your thoughts listening to what Fawn had to say.
Yeah, just, I mean, what she said about, you know, not consulting with the people who, until after the fact, and the problems that creates, and that litigation is sometimes the only where it could have been resolved, or there could have been some creative solution if the indigenous people, the landowners, those who live there, you know, who it's going to impact the most, were at the table for that dialogue and to have that conversation prior to.
And your thoughts, Daly?
I think it was really important that Fawn highlighted and underscored the disproportionate impacts upon Indian communities, indigenous communities, not only in the United States and North America, but globally. And this is certainly true for the Arctic, which is warming at rates much faster than other parts of the globe. And the impacts, We can't say enough about the impacts that we're seeing. Our people out there and on the ground, and especially in the coastal seas, and the observations and the monitoring that they're doing in terms of the impacts of climate change. So what she's underscored, I think, is really essential to make the connections that the adverse impacts, the deleterious impacts of climate change upon indigenous peoples and their communities is disproportionately higher. And the reference also that she made to the significance of our rights to lands, territories, and resources, as well as her reference to free, prior, and informed consent. And we all have to recognize that free, prior, and informed consent is sourced in our right of self-determination and the need for the opportunity to exercise and enjoy our right of self-determination in decision-making. And what she referenced in terms of access to financial resources to deal with climate change, all of the mitigation and adaptation approaches that many tribes are really the source of in terms of questioning what contributions are they making and how can they themselves as tribal nations minimize the impacts, but also deal with what they're seeing out there and on the ground. And many people are acutely aware of the impacts here in Alaska and the coastal erosion and what I would term forced relocation of their communities by virtue of this particular impact to climate change, never mind permafrost thaw and a whole host of other issues.
And also wanted to mention that Fawn Sharp is also recognized internationally. She had an international delegate position, and so her work is also international. The ICC also has international work. A lot of tribes here in Alaska work on the international level. Daly, why is that important? And also just talking about a role as a woman. I mean, Fawn Sharp having this presidency and also going internationally as an Indigenous woman.
Thank you for that question. The Inuit Circumpolar Council has been involved in international work. Obviously, we're an international Indigenous peoples organization established in 1977 to transcend the imposed national borders and to unite our people and provide the voice of our people at the international level. We were engaged in the 1992 Conference on Environment and Development, which spawned the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, the Convention on Biological Diversity, as well as other international instruments. We've worked at the United Nations, in particular, in relation to the human rights standards setting exercise that produced the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And the work now, in terms of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, is crucial. It's another one of those areas that we need to be a political and intellectual force within. And to a large extent, Indigenous peoples, through their collaborative, collective efforts, have been able to register the fact that we are distinct peoples and that we deserve a distinct status. The newest constituted body of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change is the Facilitative Working Group, which includes representatives from both state party members as well as Indigenous peoples. And one of the important distinctions about this Facilitative Working Group and Indigenous peoples is there's no oversight by UN member states as to how we elect and select our representatives to that Facilitative Working Group. And that's an enormous stride when you think about what we've been able to accomplish at the international level. In addition, I'll just conclude by saying that the work that the Inuit Circumpolar Council has done within the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has been quite significant. There, we've emphasized the importance of the knowledge that we have about our own environment, about our own ecosystems, and there are no better experts in terms of the impacts of climate change or really any other issues on our respective ecosystems than Indigenous knowledge holders. And so the importance of Indigenous knowledge and the opportunities for the co-production of knowledge to ensure that those doing the research through the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and providing data and information that between science and Indigenous knowledge, we are able to provide decision and policymakers who are, for all intents and purposes, UN member states, with the best available information, the best available knowledge that we have about the impacts of climate change. And so that work, both in the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, as well as the overall work that we're doing in interrelated fora like the International Union for Conservation of Nature, the UN Environment Assembly, and many, many other intergovernmental fora, the undercurrent, the strong undercurrent of our knowledge about our own lands and territories is significant and shouldn't be undervalued in any way.
Well, thank you so much for that. That's just some great thoughts on working on the international level and also just the progress you were talking about. And Jennifer, your thoughts?
Yeah, no, that was well said, Daley. And just really wanted to underscore, you know, what she was saying about Indigenous knowledge and science and coming together to have the full picture and framework, not only when it comes to making decisions about climate change, but for all policy decisions and across the Arctic, because our Indigenous members of, like, Daley's organization or Aleut International, like I've been involved with, we all share some of the same challenges, and that having that opportunity to inform member states express that importance of collaboration and valuing Indigenous knowledge right there with the science is so important on many levels.
And also just your thoughts too, Jennifer, on having a woman and women in leadership, like Fawn Sharp doing it internationally and as the president of the NCAI. We also had big fanfare across Indian country when Deb Haaland, a former congresswoman, became the secretary for the Department of Interior. That's a big deal, not only to have a Pueblo person, but a Native woman. Go ahead, Jennifer.
Yeah, it's just exciting times, you know, and I look through my daughter's eyes when we shared the excitement to see somebody like Deb Haaland step into that role as a female Indigenous leader. I mean, looking at Daley here as a female Indigenous leader and Fawn, there's so many. But I think in my culture, very matriarchal, the women were always there supporting. You know, I watched my grandmother support local policy and not always looked at as, you know, maybe the spotlight on her, but very heavily influenced. And, even in the Yunnan culture, the women sewed the skin boats for the hunters. So they always played an integral role in making sure that our culture survives and our people thrive. But seeing it on a big stage like the Department of Interior and Deb Haaland, total fangirl over here to see that.
Go ahead, Daley.
Yeah, absolutely. Let me echo what Jennifer has said in that regard. It is really exciting. To me, it's symbolic of us turning the corner in terms of law and policy, certainly in the United States. I hope that it is echoed across the globe. I also think that the role that women play in all of these diverse fora really reflects the exercise of good governance. Women, I've noticed more often than not the significance with which they ensure inclusion and also more transparency, more effectiveness in terms of how decisions are made. I know that some of these are important values for all Indigenous cultures, for all Indigenous peoples, nations, and communities, but when you have a woman in that position, able to embrace so many others and, again, really practice those basic democratic principles of inclusiveness, transparency, effectiveness, efficiency. And we not only do it on the international stage or the national or domestic stage or at the regional level, like throughout the Arctic Council, even at the local level, significantly we do it in our homes, right? You know, where those values, we're really able to carry them and practice them at all scales, and immediate family, extended family, community, all the way to the international level. And I think we're also seeing it emerge more genuinely in international dialogues. Most recently, there was an Arctic Encounter Symposium held in Alaska. Quite a number of the Arctic states sent ambassadors. Those ambassadors specific to the Arctic were women. And to hear a debate and discussion about Russia's invasion of Ukraine being discussed in a very substantive and genuine way by these women, it was exceptional. And actually, one of the ambassadors turned the whole question around when the reporter asked, you know, well, is this significant? Why didn't you ask that of all the men when they were together talking about security and defense? Why is it now, you know? It was like, aha, good on her, you know.
Definitely, for sure. And there are a number of tribes who are having women leaders, and there are still some tribes that, you know, women leaders have not become, you know, but it's going to happen. It's going to happen. So, but thank you both for your thoughts on that. Well, let's hear from some more tribal leaders that are here at the National Congress of American Indians. Producer Emily Schwein got a chance to talk to Ron Allen, and talking about sovereignty and why that's so important, and to get that terminology too when we're talking and looking at policies and documents to make sure that tribes are recognized as sovereign nations.
I'm Ron Allen. I'm the chairman and CEO for the Jamestown Tsklallam Tribe, located west of Seattle, about 60 miles. If you say you're sovereign, act sovereign. Well, sovereign means at all different levels, primarily the federal and state level, that they're sovereign entities. And so who they have oversight over are their citizens. Members are typically used with associations and organizations and those kinds of entities. And you can confuse who you represent. If you say to the outside world, you know, I'm a member of Ogala Lasu. And so the outside world, who doesn't understand sovereignty, doesn't understand who the tribal standing, then they'll kind of go, is that like an association? Is that an organization? What is that? No, we're a government.
So you're not just a member of an organization. You are a citizen
of
a nation.
Governmental and sovereign nation. That's exactly right. That's what that's about. And then we're trying to change that paradigm as we move into the 21st century. In the 20th century, it was almost dominated by membership. And same with, are you a tribe or are you a nation? Okay, they mean the same. Nation is more reflective of sovereignty. But some are just kind of easing their way into shifting from the old concept of a tribe or a band. I'm a band of Kumeyaay people. Okay, but you're actually a nation. You're a distinct nation. You could have multiple bands, but it doesn't matter. You're multiple nations. And so you're changing the paradigm and the perception by the outside world looking at you in terms of who you are and what you're standing in is in America. So I always say American Indian, Alaska Native governments are among the family of American government systems. So, and we're in the Constitution. You can't get rid of us unless you're going to go to amend that Constitution and take us out. So, and they're not going to do that.
And that was Ron Allen talking about sovereignty and also talking about the distinction between saying you're a citizen of your sovereign nation opposed to a member, and kind of talking about that being an association of some kind and not being a citizen, making that distinction, which I thought was really interesting. And also when I was listening to him, thinking about how tribes, sovereign nations, you know, a lot of tribes are even changing the paperwork when it comes to going by their original traditional name. So they're not, you know, tribes have taken that sovereign right back, and, you know, like instead of Sioux, Oglala Lakota or something like that, and making sure that that's in not only just spoken, but in writing. Go ahead, Jennifer.
Yeah, that was an interesting comment and a conversation I was just having with a colleague recently about that terminology and changing that mindset internally. You know, I even had said, I'm a member of the Agdawa tribe. No, I'm a citizen of the Agdawa tribe. And like making sure that, you know, we recognize that as tribal people and use that. And I think I've seen or recognized kind of a turn where, as you mentioned, they're going back to traditional names, using that correct terminology, saying citizen versus member. And that's powerful. There's power in terminology and language and how we define ourselves.
And also just, you know, a lot of people talking about the Western influence and how these things are generational, and that wasn't before, you know, we had our own tribal identities.
Yeah, I think it's important that our specific and distinct and diverse cultural contexts are reflected in the way we exercise our sovereignty and the way that we exercise our right of self-determination. And I tend to look at it from the perspective of international human rights law and international law. The right of self-determination has to be understood as a prerequisite, a requirement for the exercise and enjoyment of all other rights. So it is primary. It is the prerequisite to enjoy economic, social, cultural, spiritual, every other right, and including the rights to lands, territories, and resources, as well as the right to identify and determine the rights and responsibilities of your citizens. And so the significance of that can't be understated in any way. And the way that the right of self-determination, and in particular Article 3 of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, that affirms that all indigenous peoples have the right of self-determination, by virtue of which they determine their political status and their economic, social, and cultural development. That right is the same right afforded to all people under international law, including indigenous peoples. And that's why Article 3 of the UN Declaration is so significant and so important, because it is the source of all other rights in the UN Declaration. So what Ron Allen is saying about the power and the force of self-determination and self-government and sovereignty, it's huge. And any denial of it, any denial of the right of self-determination or sovereignty, would amount to racial discrimination, because all people should exercise the right of self-determination. And this is what governments who were opposed to recognizing the right of self-determination in the UN Declaration were arguing, is that, well, no, the self-determination of indigenous peoples is different from all others. It's like, wait a second, you've made a distinction based upon our race, and that amounts to racial discrimination, and that's highly problematic. And this is why even the term, the simple term peoples in plural, is important in the UN Declaration. So I think that what tribes are doing is really breathing life into the language of the UN Declaration including those place names, including the specific cultural context and how we refer to ourselves. And I think governments in particular need to take this all much more seriously. And it's good that Ron Allen referenced also the provision in the United States Constitution. We ourselves here in Alaska should be making reference to the 1867 Treaty of Session that recognizes and explicitly uses the term tribes.
Well, thank you so much for that. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to Alaska's Native Voice. We'll be right back. Welcome back. You're listening to Alaska's Native Voice. I'm Antonia Gonzalez from the Dena'ina Center in Anchorage, where the National Congress of American Indians mid-year gathering is taking place. And I have some great guests here today. And we're talking about policy. And we're also hearing from our producer, Emily Schwing, who went and talked to a lot of different attendees who are here. So I want to welcome back both of my guests. Jennifer, welcome back. And Daly, welcome back.
Thank you.
And right before the break, we were talking about sovereignty. Was there anything else you wanted to mention, Jennifer?
No, I think Daly wrapped it up, echoing, the comments that we heard, that is at the forefront or the foundation of everything. So.
And, oh, yep, go ahead, Daly.
Yeah, I forgot to mention that one of the discussions that is taking place at the United Nations and being led by Indigenous peoples, and in particular Indigenous political institutions, Indigenous governments, is a request, we could say a demand, for the recognition of Indigenous governments. So, for example, the Inuit Circumpolar Council is recognized as a non-governmental organization by the Economic and Social Council of the UN. The discussion that's now taking place is a desire to enhance the participation of Indigenous governments specifically, and access to the General Assembly and access to the Human Rights Council consistent with their status as governments. Not that category of civil society, of which Indigenous peoples are not a part of, and not that category of non-governmental organizations, but to arrive at the United Nations with recognition of and respect for your status as a government rather than an NGO. And I think this is a really exciting and promising discussion. I hope it doesn't take my lifetime for us to realize it, but it's going to be a struggle in the face of the norm of UN member states controlling everything. So I wouldn't underestimate the force and the power of our presence within the halls of the United Nations in this debate about the enhanced participation of Indigenous political institutions, of Indigenous governments.
And that reminds me of, you said, I hope, sometimes things take a while to get done. We do see progress and stuff, but we did have a chance to ask tribal leaders about when it comes to policy and decision making and seeing moving things forward, push it. How can tribes, advocates, people involved in this keep pressure and push it through until it does become policy? And then how does it get enacted? We talk, there's a lot of resolutions, not only here at NCAI, but AFN, other organizations. So how do tribes keep that motivation? And, once a resolution passes, what happens to it? Where does it go? So let's hear from Harold Frazier, who is the leader of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe in South Dakota.
Harold Frazier, I'm chairman of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe in South Dakota, also the vice chairman of the Great Plains NCI region.
Why is it important that tribes have a seat at the table on all levels, from local government all the way to the international level?
Well, you know, a lot of times, years back when, weren't there, a lot of decisions, a lot of legislation, a lot of laws were enacted that really was not beneficial or did not help Native American cause. So it's important that if anything has to do with the future of our people, that we need to be there and to write it ourselves.
All of these resolutions and all these policies are passed here, and then NCAI is supposed to take it and advocate on behalf of the members. What does that look like? Why is it sometimes these issues get stalled?
You know, I think it's just so many issues, and I know right now, presently, you know, there's internal issues going on with NCI, and that's something that is really frustrating because, you know, the fight's out there, and, you know, and we can't be fighting inside or internally, so that's been pretty frustrating, and just, you know, I think we need to get back to the core functions of a government and start advocating for, you know, better health care, better house, more housing, and things like that, I think would be a lot better.
And that was Chairman Harold Frazier of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe talking about why it's important to have a seat at the table, but also just brought up some things about trying to push forward and keep making progress on these issues to make sure that they become policy, and also just had an interesting perspective of not fighting with each other, and that's, you know, people have different different ideas a lot of times, and so there is conflict, there is conflict, and how do tribes work together to get over those conflicts. Jennifer, your thoughts on what Chairman Frazier had to say?
Yeah, you know, those conflicts do exist, and there's been conversations, you know, at the convention here today, and I think it's important for us to come together on the things that unite us and the things that are important to all of us as Native peoples across Indian Country and across the globe, because there are, and focus on those rather than our differences. But when there are differences in conflict, really getting together to have that dialogue and to heal from that, or to understand each other and where we're coming from, the way to get things moved through processes like via resolution through NCAI, or AFN, it's that power of unity and coming together as a collective voice of the people and expressing that importance. And so, I think it's really time that we all unite, and some of us are structured a little bit differently here in Alaska versus the lower 48, but at the end of the day, you know, we're all looking to advocate for our people and bring things back to our people and ensure that, you know, our lands, resources, and culture survives.
Go ahead, Daly.
Yeah, I think that maybe one of the important elements is to for all of us to recognize the diversity of every nation, and also to recognize that some of the conflicts are imposed and created by others. We didn't create the funding mechanisms across the board in relation to whatever issue arises, whether it's the Indian roads or housing or whatever it happens to be, that much of this in terms of the equations that are put together are by other forces. I think that's important for us to recognize as well. And just to restate what Jennifer has said, is keeping our eye on the prize, which is really ultimately the quality of life for our members. And in that regard, I think it's also important for us to recognize that we have to hold, especially in the United States, the U.S. government's feet to the fire when it comes to their fiduciary obligations. That trust responsibility and the fiduciary obligations are not handouts for Indigenous peoples in the United States. there are legal obligations and legal commitments and demanding the recognition of the diversity and demanding equitable treatment in decision-making, equitable treatment in terms of access to resources. All of these things have to be understood as a legal obligation and something that was framed between Indigenous nations and the United States government. And that government-to-government relationship exists based on the historical antecedents of our people as distinct people. And I think that we have to remember it in that fashion, especially when we bump up against state governments that are unwilling to recognize us and our status, or other forces that are unwilling to recognize us and our status and our rights and our roles. So, you know, I've heard so many people talk about special privileges and special rights. You see it in literature all the time. You know, we have to dispense with that. And each of us, especially at the tribal level, to stand up and educate people about the content of our rights in order to create more understanding and to try to curb the conflicts that might arise internally, but also recognize significantly the conflicts outside of our own communities and our own nations.
And I think that's a great segue into talking about the diversity from the work that even happens at the grassroots level. And a lot of times grassroots movements are led by young Indigenous people, and they're also really into some organizations or do direct action in their form of raising awareness, whether it's climate change or missing and murdered Indigenous people, a whole host of issues. And we saw that yesterday here with an event, and I got a chance to talk to Ruth Miller, who is an Indigenous youth advocate. Let's hear what she had to say.
My English name is Ruth Miller. My Dene'ina name is Shivaik Isin, and I'm a member of the Chuchiyang tribe of Dillingham, though my family is from Old Kijik Village in Lake Clark, and I was born and raised here in Dariyakak in our Dene'ina homelands of Anchorage. Direct action plays a very, very important role in making sure that we can maintain our narrative sovereignty, the ability to tell our own stories about ourselves. We are given a set of rules to navigate a system that was never meant to include us within a country that was founded upon our mass genocide and extermination and later assimilation. So the rules of the system were never meant to give us adequate access to decision-making or to leadership. So even though we do subscribe to what we might call an inside game, an inside strategy of changing those systems from the inside, working with policymakers, working to see us increase representation in elected office, we also have to be bold and courageous enough to recognize that some of those systems are so broken they cannot be fixed, and that our very existence is resistance to the systems that tried to drown us out. So when we engage in direct action, it is not out of a desire to scream and yell and chant. It is because we are recognizing that the systems and the rules that we have been fed will never lead us to liberation, will never lead us to an Indigenous future that is truly free and decolonized. So when we engage in direct action, we are taking the microphone back. We are taking the narrative back, and we are asserting that, you know, whatever rules are handed to us, we are more expansive, we are more beautiful, we are more courageous than those rules that were created to limit us. So direct action is a very important tactic, whatever it might be, because it often might include art, it might include poetry, it might include nonviolent direct action that brings people to their knees emotionally, that challenges these frameworks and asks us to think outside of the box, outside of these rules we've been fed, so that we can create something more beautiful together.
And that was Ruth Miller, who is a youth advocate, and talking about just some of the approaches that they take as young leaders that may be different, and also trying to get and work into the system. Jennifer, your thoughts?
Yeah, well, first of all, what an amazing young person. And she had some really, really, really interesting things to say. And, you know, and I think that's been what she was saying is just the constant challenge. And it just, if one new set of systems, another new set of systems. And as we talked about at the beginning of the program, that importance of, you know, as she called it, playing the inside game or being at the table. You know, I think that's how we could create solutions that work for everybody when it comes to things. I was having a conversation with somebody recently about, like, you know, the Village Public Safety Officer program and why isn't it working? Well, it's not working because in their village because they didn't consult with them and they didn't realize that you can't take people from their community to a training far away and, you know, expect success. So they had different ways of looking at it and were very successful with it. But that's including consultation with the local leaders, your indigenous knowledge and understanding, you know, what you're trying to do and the impacts that will have and just the importance of it. And,
Daly? Well, I think that every possible tool needs to be used. And strategies to gain success oftentimes by tribes, by indigenous peoples, employ every tool available. And that's sort of how I see the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. It's one tool that can be utilized certainly at the international level, but the use of direct action and the comments that Ruth was making, I think, are significant and important. At the same time, I think it's, as I was referring to the right of self-determination, that the role of tribes and them determining the priorities, them determining the strategies, them determining the solutions in the context of their exercise of the right of self-determination should never be lost in the larger picture. And I heard her reference to that in the comments that she made, because in the end of the day, it is those tribes and their political institutions, their elected leaders, who have to take the tools that are necessary as well as the challenges and evolve solutions that are going to be responsive in their specific context. One example I wanted to point to is the effort for tribes to organize regionally, to link arms as tribal governments, to think regionally about solutions to climate change, solutions to the infrastructure deficit that many indigenous communities face. Whatever it happens to be, I guess my main message is that the role of tribes and their rights and their responsibilities are not lost in the diverse set of tools that can be employed by young people or all others, really, all of us as indigenous peoples.
And let's hear from another young person. Producer Emily Schwing got a chance to talk to a 15-year-old who's here learning and just having his eyes opened to all the meetings, the conversations, the policies, and stuff that he's interested in and that he wants to work on.
My name is Damian Vega. I'm from the Saboba Band of Luseno Indians in California.
And is this your first NCAI conference?
Yeah, it is.
And what do you think so far?
It seems really interesting. Like, there's a lot of cool things they're talking about, like things I didn't even, like, think about.
How old are you?
I'm 15.
It's pretty cool for a 15-year-old from California to come to Alaska.
Yeah, it is pretty cool.
Can you talk a little bit about why you think a conference like this coming to NCAI, just from your perspective as being a tribal member, why that's important?
Well, because, like, if I didn't show up to these, if the people I came with didn't show up to these, then we wouldn't, like, hear these things. We wouldn't, if we were back home doing nothing, we wouldn't hear nothing about this. But now they're talking about it, so we're actually opening our eyes to things.
It's so interesting to me. I mean, this is like, it's your first day of the conference, and it feels like what you're telling me is that your eyes are already a little bit more open to what's going on in the tribal community. Is that the case?
Yeah, that is.
And so does it make you want to learn more?
Yeah, it actually does. I'm looking forward to the next couple of days that we're going to be listening. I want to read up on all the lawsuits because there's one in San Francisco in July, I think. So the guy was saying, and I want to read up on that, like see how the case goes.
What's the case on?
I think it was a student in Arizona. They rejected him from graduating because he had his beaded cap. So they're filing a lawsuit against that.
What do you think? What do you think about that case?
Well, the kid should be allowed to wear the beaded cap because, like, it could be like mean honor to him and stuff like that. And the honor students who, like, you know how they wear the, what is it?
Yeah, the graduation, like,
yeah,
robes.
Like,
and
they can wear
yeah.
stuff like that, but, like, we can't wear other things. It just don't make sense.
And that was Damian Vega, a 15-year-old here taking part at NCAI, and just listening to him, already learning about policies and want to change policies. And what he's referring to even is was recently in the news here in Alaska. There's tribes, Native Indigenous youth across the country who are honored not only with their beaded caps, their medallions, and also their eagle feathers. And so that's their way of honoring that they're showing honor and respect for their Indigenous culture. Jennifer, you go first, and just your thoughts on this young man coming to NCAI and, you know, rubbing elbows with all these seasoned tribal leaders.
Yeah, well, how amazing for him to take the initiative to be here. It sounds like there's a new Indigenous lawyer possibly in the ranks coming up. One comment that he had at the end in referring to what you're asking is, it just doesn't make sense. Like, it doesn't make sense that we shouldn't be able to celebrate our culture and who we are, or, you know, with something as simple as beads or a feather or on your cap at a school graduation or every day, you know. And I feel like, you know, while it seems like it's a little bit more, you know, welcomed and allowed, but, you know, we shouldn't have to ask for permission to be able to do those things. And yeah, it doesn't make sense. And it shouldn't be that way, to use his words.
And it's also hair, too. That's still in the news today with Indigenous kids in the lower 48 getting their hair cut at school without their permission, or even not even being allowed to wear their hair, you know, how they traditionally want to. Go ahead, Daly.
Yeah, I think that the clash of cultures, and if we think about ourselves as the original inhabitants of this territory, and then the superimposition of rigid rules, including those close to our hearts and our minds as Indigenous persons, as Indigenous peoples, it really does suggest a clash of cultures. Yet at the same time, when we hear about immigration policies and welcoming, even for example now, those from Ukraine that are trying to flee a conflict, and you look at the history of injustices and conflict from an Indigenous perspective, it is difficult to even imagine that you would have to ask permission. And I think that that's the one force and power of the right of self-determination, is to exercise it in a way that doesn't put you ever in the place of asking permission for such an elementary or fundamental characteristic such as beads or medallions or the length of your hair or anything else that makes you stand up taller and even more proud of who you are as a person. It also suggests that all of the evidence of the trauma that people carry with them on a day-to-day basis. And many think that, you know, if you take into account the whole exercise of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in Canada and the boarding schools, the residential schools, the so-called discovery of all these children who were buried en masse, you know, it it really makes me wonder if we can ever achieve the reconciliation that's hoped for by so many leaders when we have a total lack of understanding of the distinct cultural context of our people. We've been working, all of us around here, right here in front of me, been working for decades at trying to, you know, crumble all of that. But how many more generations do we have to see struggle? I think we have lightened the load for the next generation, but clearly there's still so much more to do. More power to him and his people. The final thing I'll say is that the Inuit Circumpolar Council as an organization has worked to engage young people in all of our activities as well. We have what's referred to by the ICC's Alaska office, the Emerging Leaders Program, that ensures that they can follow and engage in the work that we do at the international level, but we need more in the way of resources and more space for young people to join and express themselves and express their perspectives and priorities as to what they're facing, including harrowing issues like the high rates of suicide and many, many other issues. It's important questions.
Well, thank you so much for that, Daley, and thank you for your time today and definitely helping emerging leaders. And it's great to see young people here at NCAI and getting into all Indigenous people getting into all types of career. And shout out to my Native American journalists and the students out there, because we need more. We need more of us sharing our stories. And there are already storytellers. Everyone seems to have some kind of smart device out there that they're already sharing information and stories. But thank you to both my guests. And we're wrapping up the end of the hour here. Such a great discussion. I want to thank you both. And just real quick, Jennifer, any thoughts before we leave the hour today?
Thank you for this opportunity and your time, and to sit and have conversation with Daley. And, you know, I think just to end on what you said, Antonia, is, and Daley mentioned too, is bringing in, making a space for those young people. Like, I think we've done a lot. I once considered myself a young leader, but I, you know, it's you just keep going. But, you know, it's time to encourage those that will come behind me and to lift them up and make sure this work continues on.
Well, thank you so much, both of you, for joining us today. And thank you to our listeners and our producer, Emily Schwing. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. You've been listening to Alaska's Native Voice, a production of Kuwanic Broadcast Corporation. And this show was supported by the Climate Justice Resilience Fund.